Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Songwriters on Process podcast. My name is Benno Papari, and since 2010, I've run the Songwriters on Process website, where you can find more than 200 conversations with songwriters about the creative process. I'm not here to talk about tour stories, band drama, how a band got its name, or favorite foods. My goal is to treat songwriters as writers, plain and simple. This is an intelligent conversation about the writing process between two writers. And this week's interview is with Julian Lage. Lage is an improvisational jazz guitarist, I guess how you could describe him. But this was new to me. I mean, I've had this site for 12 years, 300 plus interviews. And this is, I believe, the first time I've interviewed a songwriter who does not write words, only instrumental music. I've interviewed guitarists who are in bands with vocalists, Mark Morton from Lamb of God, Richard Ahn from OAR, and I'm sure a few others. But this is the first time. This is the first time I've interviewed someone who doesn't write any words. So this was new to me, and I loved it. And Lage has been hailed as the one of the most prodigious guitarists of his generation. He is on the faculty at the New School and in New York. And so there was a lot of conversation here, as you can imagine, about just, I guess, the abstract element of creativity. I mean, there was no talk of rituals, not much talk of ritual, certainly no talk of revision and words and lyrics and things like that. So this was I love this conversation because this was, and I'm not going to pretend to even know the world that he is in as far as instrumental guitarists. This was an education for me, which is why I loved it, listening to him talk. Lage is married to Margaret Glaspy, who I interviewed a couple of years ago. Did a dual interview with Glaspy and Sarah Jarosz, so check that out on the site as well. But this was, again, not a conversation about rituals. I mean, he's largely an improvisational guitarist. So you'll hear this is a different kind of conversation. The audio is spotty at times on my end. I'm often at the whim of wherever I'm doing these interviews from, hotel rooms, things like that. So I apologize for that. I also have a cold right now, so my nose is a little stuffy, and I'm doing this from a hotel room in Boston. But I hope you enjoy this. Lage's new album on Blue Note Records is called View with the Room. And like I said, he's a teacher, and he's well known as a teacher too. He obviously is a touring guitarist. But listen for some there's a little pedagogical talk here, what he tells his students and things like that. So anyway, you know, I think the one thing that stuck out, because I tried to kind of focus at some point this on the ritual, but obviously we didn't really go too deep into that. But he said that he found that when he was writing really well, I think, on airplanes, in that small cramped space in an airplane seat. And so when he would get home, he would try to recreate that space by writing in a very cramped place. And I've never heard that before, but I love that story. So this was great. I enjoyed this. As again, new territory for me, not talking about words. And enjoy my interview with Julian Lage. All right. The first thing I always start with is I'm always interested in, you know, the creative processes of artistic types. And what's interesting is there are so, when it comes to at least writers, yeah, you know, they talk about, you know, and I read these interviews with writers who talk about it's important to create every day, you know, yeah, butt in the seat doing something. Yeah. But when I talk to songwriters, I don't hear that as much. It's more of that kind of write when the inspiration strikes, create when the inspiration strikes. And if you're not feeling it, yeah, don't do it. But it's, you know, but we talk to other creative types, that's not normally the case. Now, I am interested in why that is different. And I guess two-part question. I mean, is it important to create every day? Yeah, let's start with that.
Well, I mean, that's the question, you know, for me always is, and it's somewhat of a line of inquiry, you know, depending on what's going on in life. Like, is it right for me to write every day, given that I'm on tour? Is it right to write every day, given that I'm off of tour? And so I think that's kind of one of those evergreen questions that has different answers at different times. Platonically speaking, I think writing every day is wonderful. And I also see, I've seen moments in my writing period past, you know, I'd say that where I'm overdoing it. You know, I'm committing everything to the page as if it's got to be something. And I've, you know, I've benefited from my father's advice at times, is just step away, you know, just take a minute, whether it's a day, a week, a month, like, you'll know. And I think I've suffered quite a bit, at least on just a conditioned mind level, thinking that if I'm not writing every day, I'm not contributing as well. You know what I mean? It's kind of one of those classic ways of beating yourself up. You set a schedule, you do it well enough to feel good, you miss part of it, and then you might as well just quit. You know, it kind of spirals like that. So all to say, I have a dynamic relationship with it. The way I write, I think, is conducive to daily work. And I don't think it always has to have a goal. Even if some, you know, for me, writing a song within 10 minutes every day is kind of a good way to just keep things moving. And then, like I said, there are times where that just doesn't really fit because I'm in the improvisational realm and I don't want to codify things. But by and large, absolutely. Daily writing is just, it's also fun. You know, for me, from just a spiritual point of view, it's a practice. You know, it's like meditation or going for a run or what have you. So for that reason alone, I think it's worth doing every day because I feel better. Really, I really do.
Do you write on tour, or is that, I mean, some people say they deliberately don't write on tour. So
yeah, it's different for everybody. And every tour is kind of different. I've come to love writing on tour. For years I didn't. I thought, okay, you're there to play, you know, you're there to be present. And especially the music we play, which I think of as improvised music, by and large, you know, the job is presence. The job is freedom, agility, responsiveness. And I think the disposition I have when I'm writing might be a little more linear. You know, I'm going to investigate. Like, I'm sure it's like for you or any great writer, it's like you have to build this thing step by step. And so all to say, for years, I kept them separate. I would say about a year ago, especially after the pandemic or the height of it, having us in lockdown kind of came to a, I wouldn't say end, but shifted. So I found myself touring, going out for a week here, a week there. I think I felt like I didn't want to waste time. I didn't want to assume that when I got home, I could take this time. You know, I'll write later when I'm settled and don't need to, you know, no. Just do it when you have an impulse. That kind of became the MO. Furthermore, I think, at least for the music I play, it's helpful to play a show and then write music after the concert for me, because I am reminded of what the end goal of the composition is. You know, oh, okay, what kind of song would fit in the room we played tonight? What kind of song would work at the volume we played it tonight? Okay, it was standing room, it was a rock club. Okay, now I'm back at the hotel, I'm at my desk. What, 10 minutes, what would I have loved to open the show with? And, you know, so in other words, writing with that kind of infrastructure is more feasible on tour for me. Maybe it's akin to people who write when they're in the studio. They wait till the tape is rolling and then they start writing, you know. Kind of that, the live version of that for me.
So you said 10 minutes twice. And so yeah. I'm is that part yeah. of, because that's something I've heard a few times, actually, sure. 10, literally 10 minutes, not 5, not 15, actually 10.
Yeah, yeah.
Madison Cunningham told me that. I interviewed her and she said that she gets up every morning, writes for, someone told her that that's the way you should do it. Every morning, get up, write for 10 minutes. It's doable. It's not, you know, anyone can find 10 minutes. So is 10 minutes actually a thing for you?
It really has become one for many years now. You know, when I was very young, I took a lesson from a great teacher named Alauddin Matthew, W.A. Matthew. He wrote some fabulous books about music, The Listening Book, Harmonic Experience. And I feel very lucky. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, a town called Santa Rosa. And so Alauddin was a part of that musical community, kind of like a high-level teacher when I met him. But he had, it also was also working with people as a performer, composer, et cetera. And he was fond of improvising 1 minute compositions. And these were, this was, I think, in some ways designed to help an improviser kind of organize their thoughts. Sometimes improvisation is thought of as this endless, you know, grab it out of the sky, you know, kind of experience where you're, there's no real rhyme or reason. And I think he was trying to give it rhyme or reason. He said, well, a minute is, you know, long enough to have a narrative, right? The first 30 seconds, you make a statement. At 30 seconds, you're kind of at the bridge. 45 seconds, you have to wind it up and do like 10 of these a day. You know, record them. Don't listen to them for, let's say, a week. So if you think about it, 10 a day for a week, you have 70 minutes of you improvising. And when you listen back to the 70 minutes, you can kind of take note of any trends in your, I guess, I don't know, your style, your preferences. Like, wow, the 40 of these 70 minutes were me strumming a D major chord. Apparently, like, I like D major, right? So that was always in my head, is that, wow, what a profound thing you can get when you use time, chronological time, to your advantage when you're a practicing, improvising guitarist. You know, it actually helps. I think that kind of parlayed into when I started writing more actively for my bands, where I thought, well, there's got to be a compositional equivalent, you know, something that if you, 1 minute is a little brief to write a song, just from the mechanics of pencil and paper and all that, and writing the song. But 10 minutes is kind of more, it's like a minute in compositional world. And if you do 10 a day, every day for a week, at the end, you have 7 songs, and that's getting close to a record. So I derived it from him, I would say, pretty directly.
Yeah, that reminds me a little bit of when I was teaching, and I would tell my students, I would give that, you know, I think that it makes it more manageable if you look break it up into chunks, you know, rather than thinking of everything. And it was when I was writing my dissertation, you know, a lot of people, I think it's like, I don't know, 50% of people never finish their PhDs or something. So the rates are really high.
But
I read this book called, and it was by this this professor of education, and I think her name is Bolker is her last name. And the book was called Your Dissertation on 15 Minutes a Day. And her whole thing was, you know, if I tell you to have to write a 300-page book, people are going to say, I can't do that. But if I say write, you know, 10 pages a week for 30 weeks, I can do that. And that makes it a lot more manageable rather than the daunting, you know, several hundred page thing. And so I don't know, that's a little bit of, sounds like that's what you're talking about, that manageable chunks. And that's probably a great thing to tell students, right? I mean, as far as just creative.
Absolutely. It's an invitation to students. It was an invitation to me, you know, and I took it and I thought, oh, well, that's pretty cool. And like you say, from a pragmatic point of view, if you have this large, you know, 1,000-page project or whatever, a record, it's very beneficial just logically to break it up. I think there's another side to it, at least, that comes into focus for me more times than not. Sometimes I'm oblivious to it, but, you know, I think writing songs, at least, for me, requires perspective, and it's vital that I remember that I have very little perspective at certain key moments in the writing process. So given that I know I could write a song, take 3 hours to do it, and then a week later hear it and go, oh God, I don't know what I was thinking, or wow, that was really, you know, not that it would be that critical, but you know what I mean? That's one possible scenario. If I know, or I'm anticipating that a week later I'm going to look at this and have to assess it with perspective, 10 minutes of work is often enough to give me something to assess a week from now. Do you know what I mean? Like the impulse, the tempo, the utility of the song, the scope of it, it's all kind of often it's there in some way, shape, or form in the first few minutes you're working. Now, if a week from now I hear 10-minute composition, this is more often what happens. And I hear it back a week from now and I go, it's good, but I think it needs to graduate to another level before I can assess its whatever. Okay, then you sit down for an hour, get it to that next level. So you're kind of interacting with the future when you're writing, you know, and I think that's an interesting, the timed thing, I think, keeps me in touch with that.
Do you deliberately use, because I deliberately use distance, you know, deliberately setting things aside, looking back at them. I mean, more often than not, I feel like when I use distance, I look back and I go, I can't believe I wrote that. Than, oh my gosh, that's amazing. But do you deliberately use distance as a part of your process?
Oh, absolutely. Distance as part of the process to me is essential. And it can vary, you know, it doesn't have to be, okay, in 2 weeks, I'll check it out because maybe you only have 2 weeks to write it. But it can be, I'm going to work on something in the morning and step away for the afternoon and come back that night, you know? But it's, you know, the framework that I look at as far as distance, it is a framework of kind of self-education. Like, I think writing music is, you're kind of creating these teachers, you know? It's the same way I feel about instruments. You know, I think every guitar, for example, can, it's there to teach us something. And I don't even mean that in an existential way. I mean, literally, if the scale length of a Telecaster versus a Martin is different, you're going to learn about movement and distance, and it's going to affect the choices you make. It's one of the great educations, is just interfacing with instruments. And I think songs teach us lessons, or I should speak for myself. They teach me a lot. Like, oh, how am I going to reconcile this tempo with that key, with this improvisational section? No clue. So if I'm going to take this lesson on and really learn it, I need distance to kind of think up how to progress. Does that make sense? So you're the music's the teacher, I'm the student, and I just need that time to do my homework. It's as much that as it is, I need distance to know if I like it or not. That's a slightly different shade of it. There was a bunch of songs on this new record we just made or just put out where I just really had no clue how to achieve this direction we were going for. I just didn't get it. So it was so humbling to go, well, okay, it's Tuesday. Let me jump back in. Yep. Still don't know what a good bridge is like for this kind of melodic material. Okay. It's Wednesday. This takes it over there. I don't think it needs to go over there. Let me try. And it's just such a, like I said, it's very humbling. You know, you kind of go, wow, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. But it's a privilege to be able to take the time to learn and listen, take distance and all the other stuff.
The other thing is a lot of those, I think the guy that created Dilbert, Scott Adams, I think. He had this article in the Wall Street Journal about how boredom is an essential part of the creative process. And
absolutely, you
know, songwriters tell me that, you know, so many ideas come to them. And I think as a writer too. I have so many ideas come to me when I'm, you know, when I'm not thinking about those ideas. And so when they happen, you know, in the shower, or when they're doing, you know, other things. And so I think, does that happen a lot too, when those ideas, like what you mentioned, you revisit that and Wednesday is still not happening, but
yeah,
have those moments been unlocked when you're not prepared for them?
Not doing it. Yeah, to be honest, I've always struggled with that approach. And I have so many friends who, yeah, seem to access their creative impulse when they're not with the music, you know, and frankly, I think there's part of me that's been envious of lyrical writers, you know, and songwriters, because there's, you know, throughout the day you're using you're often using language, you know, you are communicating with language, and I think what a great writer does seemingly is they have a correlation between their native sense of language and the art they create with language. And so there's a fluidity, you know. I recognize that with instrumental music, you're dealing in another form of abstraction. So it's not to say that it's about nothing because it doesn't have words. It's just to say that we're not using words. We're using tempos and rhythms and sounds and as using them as, in a way, stand-ins for the spoken language. So I'm not going to say this, I'm going to play that, but it's going to hopefully elicit a similar emotion. So to that end, because I like language and I love words and I'm interested in communication, I feel like when I'm away from music, I'm consumed with language, like English language. And it's hard to often feel like there's space to imagine anything abstract. So for me, it's more often than not that I'm not really daydreaming about it. Sometimes there'll be structural issues that I step away and I go, oh, just cut out the B7. That's, you know, like that's almost more of a theoretical awareness, though. It's not as much a, wouldn't it be amazing if we did the, you know, I know instrumental composers, many of the greatest who do that. You know, they go out for lunch with a friend and they go, oh, I know what to do for the string quartet. They run back. You know, I'm far less like that.
Well, the other thing is that so many songwriters have told me that they get song ideas when they're doing mundane activities, you know, melodic ideas, not necessarily lyric ideas, but melodic ideas when they are. And, you know, again, whether this is a function of just people being inside for, you know, a year and a half, whatever, but it's been crazy to hear how many song ideas have come to songwriters when they are vacuuming, cleaning. I interviewed Kebmo about 6 months ago, and he told me he gets song ideas while he's folding laundry and ironing. Something about the subconscious, right? When we're doing things that require, you know, no thought whatsoever, that allows the creative mind to kind of take over.
That makes sense. Makes total sense. My experience of what you're talking about with Kebmo and others is probably pertains more to this, to a very, you know, the portion of writing that has to do with organization. Mm-hmm. In other words, you hear Duke Ellington, he's always references talking about, you know, write for the people in your band, write for the people in the band. Increasingly what I come to appreciate is that, you know, you can write anything you want. You know, you can write, it's actually not hard to write something. To write something that you feel good about is a whole nother story, but the ability to put sounds together and say it's a song is actually, I think, very universal. And I think it's available to everyone. But such a large percentage of what you're doing when you're writing is considering the human beings that you're writing for, the context it's going to be in, when it's going to happen. And I feel like those are some of the thoughts that can go on in the background more for me, that can happen during these more unconscious moments of, God, I always wanted to play with so-and-so. Wonder if they would do it. Okay, if they would do it, what would we do? Standards? Would we do, you know, I don't think I ever appreciated until more recently how much a good instrumental writer is a good kind of project manager. You know, it's a little bit different than, I've got this thing I need to get off my chest. It's not always like that. And not to make the assumption, presumption that that's what it is for lyricists, but, you know, we're talking about the world of, you know, Beethoven's going to write a fifth symphony. We already know it's called Symphony Number 5.
Right.
People are in the symphony. We know how long it's going to be. We know it's going to be premiere. I mean, there's these other things that I think make instrumental writing so fun because it's very contextual. And it can be imbued with the personality of the writer, no doubt. But it's you know, different writers have different approaches. I heard something about Philip Glass recently. John Zorn was telling me about, we ran into Philip Glass, I think at Veselka's over in the East Village. It was great. Is it Ukrainian food? Anyway, it's amazing food. Regardless, he sighs and, Phil, what are you working on? I said, well, I've got this 30-minute symphonic work that's due in a month. And he was there eating his soup. And John says, well, what are you doing here? Like, I would think, you know, he said 30 minutes, 30 days. As long as I write a minute a day, I'm cool.
You know? Right. Yeah.
And it's what you were talking about before. And it also pertains to what I'm saying now, which is that the structure of the deadline, the structure of the amount of minutes, the structure of all of these things, to someone like Philip Glass, who's such a masterful composer, he's leveraging all of those structures to liberate him, right? In that moment. That's what could be taken away from that story. And I kind of feel similarly. I'm looking for things that make it so that you can just write anything because you know who's going to play it, you know when it's due. And now you get to have the fun of being a student, basically.
It reminds me also, I would always tell my students that, you know, it lessens the anxiety about creativity doing something creatively. If you recognize that the creative process is always taking place, if you only think about it taking place when you're sitting down, that's right. Going to create a lot of anxiety. But I'd always tell them it is happening when you're eating, when you're sleeping, when you're walking. And, you know, whether they believe me is another thing, but I firmly believe that even when I'm not thinking about those things, some part of my brain, they're working, you know, working through, and it makes me feel less anxious. Right.
Well, sure. I mean, at the end of the day, I think that's the creative path there's some sense of being supported, of not being alone, going, there's mystery here. And we're very fortunate to interface with the mystery, you know? And you can beat that out of a creative person very easily and make it about achievements and make it about being proof of their value as a human being and all these other paths, which we contend with, you know? So I agree with you that it's not ever not going on, but everybody's different. Hence why you can have hundreds of interviews with different people that all probably offer different perspectives. It's pretty, pretty wondrous.
And you mentioned running, and I'm a big runner, and I've written about this actually, the very clear link. I've written about this in the Washington Post, the very clear link between, aerobic exercise and the immediate impact it has, not long-term, the immediate impact it has on higher order thinking, executive function, creativity. And what they've done is and it's been replicated in the lab. They've put people on a treadmill for 20 minutes at 60% max heart rate, which is like a moderate walk, and then give them a battery of tests afterwards. And those people always score higher than people who weren't exercising. There's a chemical called brain-derived neurotrophic factor that's secreted with increased blood flow, and that's exercise. It's about 90 minutes post-exercise, your creative peak. It's fascinating stuff because, and there's certain parameters that exercising in an urban environment isn't as effective because you're practically trying not to get hit by cars, and a natural environment is ideal. Yeah. I mean, and even things like treadmills aren't quite as effective if you're going to be indoors than like a bike, because in a treadmill, there's some measure of balance going on. You're trying to not fall off the treadmill. So 90 minutes post-exercise. I mean, this has been, the studies are fascinating. I mean, I've written about this and because I think it has enormous implications for all people, whether they're
absolutely,
no matter what they do, you know, if you can use that as a part of your routine. So I absolutely do. And I don't, you know, I'm not to say I run for 30 minutes four times a day, but I find that when I am in a rut, that's when I go take a walk. And so I'm curious if that is something that you use either consciously or if that's happened, because you did mention running. So,
well, no, absolutely. It's funny. My wife, Margaret, she's the runner in our household, and I bicycle. I love bicycles and cycling, and it's 100% fulfilled what you just described. You know, it's this, we live in a lovely area where I can ride on a trail. So similarly, like to what you're saying, it's, you know, I take the ride over there, dodging cars, or, you know, I go on a path where there's not many cars, but I'm very high alert because I don't want to get hit. But as soon as I get to the trail where it's only bikes or people walking, there is a sense of catharsis that emerges where it's a sense of freedom that I do feel stays with me when I come back to the practice room or the writing session or whatever it is. It's something I actually, you know, I'm kind of like dependent on now. Okay, this is this thing that I need to do. And it's what you're saying, you know, obviously makes sense because you know what's going on, but experientially makes sense to me, resonates with me. In any variation, going for a walk, moving around. It's funny how, I mean, this is not novel in any way, but it is funny to me increasingly how when I am writing and I need that kind of break we're talking about, and I look, let's say, at text messages or my phone I don't personally get to it. Social media is not something that's on my radar directly. It's what we do it as a team, because I think it's healthier for me. But so it's really just texts. I look at texts from people. You know, when I check with that world as a form of taking a break from writing, especially if I've been working for a while and writing, it feels so small. That world feels so, just feels like a piece of candy. Like it's kind of like, it's unattractive in the sense that I'm like, that doesn't feel nourishing. And I can see it so clearly. And so I often feel very grateful that working creatively can kind of sharpen my senses and go, I don't want to look at my phone for the next 10 minutes. I'm going to go for a walk. That decision seems far easier coming from the creative sphere. And then when not in the creative sphere, it seems like, oh, it's so convenient. I'm going to take a break and I'll choose digital over going for a walk.
But on the flip side, cool. And I've been mentioning the study that I read to all these songwriters. There was a study about a year ago about the state that we're in right before we fall asleep. And I always forget the term for it. There is a term for it. Yeah. And I forgot what it's called, but it's not sleep and it's not awake. It's that hazy spot right when you're kind of semi-conscious. So in this study, and they reference Salvador Dali, because what he would do as a part of his process, and there's a picture of him actually in the studies in the Smithsonian Magazine, is he would hold a skeleton key. And he's sitting in an uncomfortable chair, holding a skeleton key in an outstretched hand, and with a saucer on the floor below it. When he would go to drift off, he'd let go of the key, key would drop and make a sound, and he'd go to create. So he would make that a part of his process. And so it's they've actually studied this too, that, you know, so this is the exact opposite of exercise.
But, right.
It's funny. I'm thinking about this right now, and I've never really thought about how, wow, we're talking about two different things, how exercise stimulates creativity, but so does that space when you're doing the exact opposite of that. and plenty of creative types, you know, tell me that they get those ideas in the middle of the night, but that's not what we're talking about. It's that hazy state. And so he would go and he'd go to paint and he would use that as a part of his process.
So cool.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Go ahead. I'm curious.
That's amazing. That's fascinating. And two, it's, I think what's interesting to me overarchingly in both scenarios is that we're talking about awareness about one's experience of life, you know, that, like, if you know, noting that, you know, what you experience through exercise, what you experience through the space before you fall asleep, what you experience in any condition is valid, you know, and though that's kind of like, well, duh, of course it's valid. I think so many systems in life really make certain things seem like valid ways of operating and other ones are not valid ways of operating. And the creative sphere, I think, leaves room for, what do you make when you're just tired? Like, I had a friend who, growing up, great drummer, Daryl Green, he said, you got to start practicing when you're really tired. And I didn't really get it. And then I started doing it. And I said, why did you recommend that? And he said, well, because you're going to get to gigs and you're going to be tired. And you want to know that you have access to these faculties. And I thought, that's awesome. That's so cool. And I did. And it helped me in a way make peace with myself. So rather than going to the gig and going, oh, I should have slept, or wow, I need coffee, or I just go, oh no, this is just another kind of lens to look at the world through. So I'm intrigued by anything that celebrates our actual experience. I do just feel as an overarching thing though, it's you know, I've caught myself, and this is why I call it overarching, because it spans my whole life as far as I remember. I've caught myself really trying to pinpoint what I do that's good and what I do that I don't like, what I create that is good, what I create that I don't like. All these, it's almost, there's a governor that is always there for me and I'm looking for it. And often it's subjective. And often my feelings about what I did and what was good or what was a change. And increasingly, I feel like I am appreciating what I saw, especially in Chick Corea, you know, when I talked to him a lot about composition. Just we only played once, but I was lucky to be around him a bit. And he's just a good example because he's such a pillar of creative creativity and life force. That was Chick. I feel like saying it is Chick still eternally, but he had this disposition that seemed like he was like, everything is just a miracle that you make in any state of any quality of any duration for anybody. It's like, that's your way of saying thank you to the universe, is you make something. And you can get caught up so easily, as I have, in like I say, discerning, being kind of trying to govern what's good and what's not. And now, you know, here's my peak, this, here's my peak, that. But every time I was around him, I immediately go home and just write and just be like, it's amazing that anything comes out. It's amazing that we do anything. It's amazing that it's just amazing. So I think of utmost importance to me is just a high level of gratitude, like I'm grateful for the time, grateful for the resources, grateful for the results, grateful for the experience. That to me can illuminate any state of mind you're in. You know, to me, it kind of is, it dominates. Whether I'm tired, awake, I'm just going, I want to write from a place of thank you. Thank you for this.
So when it comes time to the ritual, then, I mean, are there, for me at least, I know there are certain times of the day when I'm more effective. Like, is there a certain, for me, it's confidence and just knowing that, you know, for example, like for me, I write in this chair, but I revise in that chair behind me.
Makes sense.
But that's part of my ritual. Right. Time of day, place. Do those things matter to you? I mean, is there a certain room, or like, are you a morning person, sure, night person, and stuff like that?
Well, you know, the very unglamorous answer is not real. You know, I feel part of the style of writing I partake in, you know, it involves being on the move. It involves being in different time zones and it kind of relinquishing. I had this notion for years that, cause I used to write a lot of music when I would sit on airplanes just and get my pad of paper and use the seat back table in front of me. And when I'd come home, I'd try to work in the same amount of space as that seat back table, which is only, you know, it's like a foot, if that, it depends what airplane you're on. And my thinking was that when I come home, I won't get used to luxuriating with all this room and then when I go on tour, I won't feel like I've been deprived of my ritual. And it's a little bit silly, but it was always, it actually, I produced a lot of stuff because I felt like, yeah, time, place, surface area doesn't matter. Just kind of get to it. So that speaks to kind of my overall ritual. Suppose I have a record date 2 weeks from now and I need 10 songs and nothing's written. What does that look like? Well, and I'm home, let's say. For me, that's very much a start your day with writing, have lunch, keep writing, have dinner, revise, go to bed. You know, that's, I enjoy those longer kind of like a form days, you know, if I can. That's the ideal scenario, but and it's kind of what I do. I don't, I don't do terribly well pushing through a problem, you know, like I know people who can, you know, people have that amazing ability. It's like, they're like clutch writers and, you know, it's due the next morning. They haven't started. It's 9 PM and they just spend all, I often have found that when I do that, I'm just a mess and I created something I'm not proud of. So yeah. I know my limits in terms of that, or at least I sense it, but most importantly, I think what I get excited about as a writer is that these things can change, you know, and that the what feels good at one point in life doesn't have to feel good forever. To be quite honest, I've as a teacher, I'm always very sensitive about laying out effective practices to students. It, obviously not as a rule of thumb, but let's say you have someone who's really advanced or even someone who's intermediate and they're trying to kind of develop their own relationship to writing. I hesitate to give them any sense of like, well, this is what works for me, because I know for myself, when I would get some of that advice, I held myself to other people's rules and approaches and suffered quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, I would, you know, well, they could do it like this. And so it's like, okay, well, what's your thing and what's appropriate for you? And it's not to say I haven't encountered people who I'm completely aligned with. And I go, you also are doing that right now. And that's great. But I think part of the beauty is like it matching where you are in your life at your age with your circumstances. I think that's, it just takes a lot of that pressure off.
That is huge. And the parallel I would say is, you know, we're all taught in like third grade, you know, the linear outline, writing papers, one, right. A, B, two,
exactly.
A, B. And, you know, that's a weird kind of way to write, because people aren't, when it comes to brainstorming, we're not linear thinkers.
No.
Like no one thinks, let me think about this. Now I'm going to think about this. And so why were we taught this linear outline? It's like a square yes. peg in a round hole. Like we're not linear thinkers and yet we're told to write this way. And so I would tell my students, I have no right telling you how you should create. You have to know what it is. You have to find a process that fits who you are as a writer and as a thinker.
Yes.
And the linear form of outlining to me was the worst type of outline known to humankind, because no one thinks like that. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And I agree.
It's exactly
this.
It.
I have no right telling you. You have no right telling. No one has any right telling you. You just have, you have to guide people towards that and get right. and help them find that way. But that always drove me crazy when it was this idea that you've got to do this, and no one stopped and thought, well, why? Just because we were told that?
Yeah, right. And somehow if you do something different, you're deviating in it. And I think right. it's funny because it obscures the notion, you know, the truth of the matter, which is this is all abstraction. These are abstract print, you know, mechanisms to make sense of a very mysterious world.
Yeah.
I think the comfort we get, or I've gotten from teachers, or I hope to be function as a teacher with other writers or students or whatever it might be, is just to say that like, you're not alone. We're not alone. There is language around this. There are people who struggle with similar things, you know? That kind of camaraderie is at least for me, it's profound. I go, wow, there's someone else who's really thinking about this. You know, it's what you provide right. in this conversation and what you've done in this podcast. It's that's profound, you know, because I just think without that, then it's really scary.
Yeah.
Then
yeah.
you're really, oh, well, what am I doing? No one else thinks it's important. So why should it? I guess maybe it isn't important. And I think our role is to say it's important, you know, and yeah. you have to figure it out for yourself. And that's part of the fun.
Right, exactly. Not telling anyone this is the way it's got to be done, but helping people at least recognize what it is within their own strengths, and then working with that. So,
beautifully said.
Okay, last question. Since you did mention two words,
yes.
You know, tell me, how much reading do you get to do? Who do you like to read?
I'm a terrible reader. I love words, and I'm slow, and I get tripped up. So I've been working on like two or three books for about 5 years. One is Joseph Camp, this biography about Joseph Campbell, Fire in the Mind. It's a beautiful book. I think it's written by a husband and wife, and I don't have the physical copy anymore. It's in the Kindle, so I just read that. And I just kind of read parts of it and go back and forth. I've been reading the Thelonious Monk biography for a while, which is a beautiful book. And frankly, I have certain pet peeves around documentation about musicians, I think, that keep me from wanting to read a lot of biographies. But in this case, oh, it's fascinating. Everything from, you know, how much he was paid for his record deal to when he started playing piano and this, that, other. And I don't feel so alone. I read and I go, oh, Thelonious Monk was on planet Earth. How cool. Cause to me, he's such a god, and he still is. And then beyond that, there are, you know, I have a certain, Zen practice that I followed for quite some time, led by a teacher named Sherry Huber. And it's unorthodox in many regards, but Sherry Huber wrote a book, very important book for me. I read years ago called There's Nothing Wrong With You. And she wrote all these follow-ups to it. It basically looks at, just conditioned mind and how we, kind of get bamboozled into believing that voice in your head that says you suck is true, is a real voice. And she's just got a very creative and interesting way of dealing with it. So I find myself reading so many books by her, just as reminders, kind of touchstones, you know. But as far as being someone who reads constantly, I would say, you know, I always have a Kindle with me. I'm always reading something. But it's very rarely comprehensive. I don't get to the end. I'll say, oh, there's this book about, you know, Shakespeare about his early, you know, early childhood. I always wonder, I'll read two chapters and go, okay, I'm cool. And 6 months later, I'll maybe return to it. So it's funny how that works with me. I love language, but I through reading, it's not even that I'm not good at it. It's just that I'm slow and I'm at peace with that. My wife is a far more voracious reader and collects books and has a whole library. That's where I am with it now. I'm okay with it. I like it. I like chipping away.
Well, it reminds me, Hemingway once said all writers should go to art galleries. He was always big, I think, on you know, artists of any stripe going outside of their field and getting inspired by other types of creativity.
That makes perfect sense. You know, it makes and music often is. This isn't historically the case, but I think in present history, there's been this almost removal of music from the arts. You know, musicians are musicians, and then there's writers, painters, and all the rest. Right. And I do believe that we are all the same cloth. And as far as reading something whether it's reading or film, television, whatever it might be, one thing that's been of increasing interest to me is that there are many types of narratives countless narrative styles that I would like to be familiar with, because I think it would help inform the narratives I'm writing compositionally. And it's funny, that's only within the last couple of years where I thought, not reading because I think I should, but I actually would love to find some variations on this one type of arc that I keep finding myself going to, or, I feel like there's enough pieces I've written in recent years where I go, they tend to have a similar punchline. They tend to have a similar rhythm. Obviously we're talking on a song level, but it all relates to a larger narrative, you know, and I would like to see deviations, and I would like to understand what my options are. So I've had this kind of pipe dream to set aside time or if not time, at least, some sort of plan of reading or research to go, I've kind of been dealing in short stories basically for many years. Yeah. What are my options for longer form narratives? What does it look like in writing? What does it look like in film? What does it look like in music? That's the correlation I'm always kind of interested in.
And that's it for the latest episode of Songwriters on Process. Don't forget, you can find all of my interviews with over 200 songwriters on my Songwriters on Process website at songwritersonprocess.com, going all the way back to 2010. You can read them, watch them, or listen to them. So until next time, thanks for listening.